Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
They're all having dinner like an Avengers movie, like a Marvel movie, in this wonderful restaurant in Oslo. The telegram boy rushes in with the news that Natalia has disappeared. Now, and the Norwegian government wants kind of volunteers to help search for the airship. And one of the observers says everyone in the room knew Amundsen and Nobly hated each other. So what was Amundsen going to do? And he stands up and goes, "Tell them I am coming."
Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Mark Pysin has a passion for aviation, history, innovation, and exploration. He has explored Britain's Area 51, found the last surviving Nazi helicopter, and flown drones inside a fusion reactor. A world's first, I'm told. He's written for the BBC, the Smithsonian's, Air and Space Magazine, The Guardian, The Independent, Wired, and The Economist. The true story of the largest polar rescue mission in history is pretty much unknown in most aviation circles until now. Mark's the author of N4 Down, the desperate race to find the survivors of the glamorous Arctic airship Italia, which crashed near the North Pole in 1928. Mark, welcome to Extended.
Thank you, Peter. It's great to be here.
Very, very grateful for having you come on the show. Fabulous book. Reads like a thriller. Really, really enjoyed it.
Brilliant.
Picked it up, read it in less than a week, couldn't put it down. Not a topic I think it's fair to say I was familiar with, but I saw the reviews flashing through social media and it just caught my eye. So tell me a little bit before we talk about the story, in where the heck did this idea for this this book come from?
That's a really good question. I was researching a book, a popular kind of history of airships, because there are so many great characters, so many disasters and heroicism, and no one had attempted to write this kind of popular history before. So I was working with my agent on this book, and as I was bringing it together, I came across this story. I still remember seeing it now, actually at this desk, I found it, of this Italian airship that crashed near the North Pole, and half the crew floated away, never seen again. Another half had to fight for the survival on the ice. And I just thought, wow, this is an amazing story. Oh, this is probably a bit more exciting than the book I'm writing. But, I'm new to this publishing game, so I didn't feel I could say to my agent, "I think we're going down the wrong route," because I sold her on the vision for the other book. So pitched it to publishers. Some rejected, some interest, but one publisher came back and went, "I don't want this big book. I just want a book about this airship that crashed near the North Pole." And really, when he said that, I didn't really know much more. I didn't know much more about it than that. And so I had 6 weeks or something to write a new proposal, which is quite a daunting prospect. And that's when, as I began my book, as I say in the introduction to my book, I got this old secondhand book, from 1930, by Nobly, The Adventures of the Italia, and the kind of the old cutting, fell out from even earlier, from 1928, April 1928, and the map dropped out the back. I mean, that all did happen. It's not just the screenwriter in me that did actually happen, and that obviously changed everything, because it was an his main character, main protagonist, Umberto Nobly, his eyewitness record of what went on near the North Pole in 1928.
Now, you had, as you mentioned briefly there, started writing another book about airships, and a lot of that detail you've been able to use in this book. Just before we go on to talk about some of those key characters, Mark, can you give us just a bit of a flavour for what the airship industry and aviation was like at that time? Because it was quite a complex but advanced industry.
It was. I mean, it was complex, seemingly advanced, but actually probably quite at a prototypical or sort of kind of prototype level, really. It's kind of a very contradictory. So in the 1920s, there was a perception that the future of aviation could be fixed wing aircraft. It could be airships, probably going to be something of the two. You just have to look at the fiction and the draw or the paintings of the day. There's a wonderful one in the, I think it's in the Acton Underground Museum, London Transport Museum, the future of London. And you've got a skyline and you've got kind of aircraft and airships flying around. So it's very much credible future, whether it's part of the future or sole future, certainly for long distance travel. And there are lots of projects to make this a reality. Really coming out of the First World War, when airships were used a great deal, now in their hundreds, in anti-submarine roles, reconnaissance roles, in kind of the Blitz of London, the first Blitz, and even the crazy German attempt to fly to East Africa by airship, and they had to turn back when they were nearly there. So a lot of technology development had gone on in the First World War. So it seemed really credible. And you had a few big players, I guess, you could say, by the time of this book, you had the kind of Hugo Eckner and the Zeppelin Company in Germany. They were really hamstrung by the Treaty of Versailles. So any airship they built, they had to get permission from the Allies to build it. And obviously lots of European nations didn't like the idea of Zeppelins flying above their cities again. And then you had probably Umberto Nobili was one of the other ones in Italy, and he built kind of what's called semi-rigid. So they have a metal kind of spine with a kind of the envelope above it. And he was certainly a leading figure in the industry. And then you had kind of the Americans and the British had these visions of huge airships to link empires and trade empires together.
And just explain to the listeners, and again, just for me, Mark, for my naivety on this, there were different types of airship as well. There was the semi-rigid and the rigid, and I'd always assumed there was one type of airship, a frame, something wrapped around it, and it was full of some sort of air or hydrogen or whatever it may be, some sort of gas. But that's not quite the case, is it?
No. I mean, they all have an envelope with a lifting gas, basically. I suppose that's what makes an airship, and some kind of propulsion, to kind of push it through the air. There's some aerodynamic lift as well, especially as the design's developed. I mean, I think children's party balloon, but with a kind of propeller on. Basically, you had three kinds. One was kind of a blimp, which is basically a huge envelope. There's no kind of structure, wasn't supported by anything, and it lifted up a gondola. So that's kind of the easiest, the cheapest to use. The other extreme was a kind of the German Zeppelin, the kind of rigid airship, where you had this huge metal structure with skin over it, and inside it you had gas cells.
Yeah,
and they were huge aircraft, very kind of expensive to build, very complex. And then in the middle, you had the semi-rigid, which had kind of had almost like the structure, like a spine, and then the envelope, gas cells would go above that. So, so the Germans specialized in the Zeppelin, these kind of huge rigid airships, because it's kind of industrial. And I think the Italian economy, which wasn't quite as developed, this kind of semi-rigid design was quite good, suitable for their level of industrialization. So.
Right. Okay. Well, let's start talking about some of the characters then. And let's start with Roald Amundsen, a name familiar to most in terms of his exploration exploits. And he, let's tell tell us a little bit about Roald and the Norge and that story and how that came about.
Okay, that's a brilliant question because I gave a lecture at the National Maritime Museum the other week, and I began with a picture of Amundsen in 1911, how we imagine him, you know, tall, proud, strong, determined, covered in furs at the ends of the earth. You know, he just got to the North South Pole, beat Scotland and Antarctic there. So he was the real hero. And that's how we often imagine Amundsen. But this is a later Amundsen. You know, he'd done all that. He'd become an aircraft, enthusiast. He'd become obsessed with the ability of aviation to transform the explorer's life, perhaps not realizing it would replace the explorer. Because anyone could become an explorer, they don't have to be these strong, kind of physically fit people. But he became obsessed with it, which is really bad because he's never very good at handling money. So it's just going to lead him into bankruptcy after bankruptcy, money troubles. And his obsession really developed, kind of from the 1920s onwards, especially to fly to the North Pole. So 1922, 1923, 1924. 1925, tried to fly to the North Pole. Each of those times, I met with, you know, increasing degrees of success, but also still failure. So 1925, he landed about 100 miles south of the North Pole in two flying boats, Dornier walls, state-of-the-art machines that could kind of land on the ice or land in the levees between the ice. And they'd had fuel problems, you know, and they had to land and they got damaged on the landing. And there's only one aircraft that they could assemble out of the two. And then they had to spend 3 weeks, and then they had to spend 3 weeks kind of building this horrendous kind of ice runway, you know, from the moving, ever-changing sea ice. So, I think Lincoln Ellsworth said, you know, this is the kind of, you know, he's never seen a place of death before, but this is what is what this is going to be. And they were really facing that. And even Amundsen apparently was rising to a challenge, but people observed that he could see this could be the end.
He had come close to losing it again there. Before we go on to talk about the Norge, there's one thing that is challenging, and the thing about exploration to the North Pole versus the South Pole is that the North Pole is always moving. There's no stability in it. Just give us a bit of a flavour for the sort of territory they were attempting to try and find this point.
Yeah. I mean, the big advantage, obviously, the big difference between the North Pole and the South Pole is the South Pole is on a continent, and somewhere below all the ice and snow, there's actually land. And if you put your flag in the South Pole and then Scott would have seen Amundsen's flag and he knew that Amundsen had made it and Amundsen could take pictures and do very exact calculations to show he had made it to the South Pole. The problem with the North Pole is the North Pole is actually in the Arctic Ocean and you've got sea ice which moves around all the time to greater varying degrees. So there's every chance if you put your flag on where the North Pole is, it might not be there when anyone else gets there. So you have much greater burden in the sense of trying to get the evidence together as you journey to the North Pole to show that you'd got there. And that could be really detailed mathematical calculations of your navigational records, accurate records, consistency, because people would pore over these explorers' records afterwards. And so it's hard to prove. And you know, two guys, Cook and Perry, both claiming to have got to the North Pole, you know, and there are varying degrees of doubt, you know, about whether they did or they didn't. And there
was also, Mark, the challenge that whoever got to the North Pole may also be able to get past the North Pole to see what was on the other side, because it wasn't known predominantly by these exploration countries in the Northern Hemisphere, what was on the other side of the North Pole. You had obviously the Soviet Union over on the east, you had Alaska on the west, but it wasn't known whether there was land beyond that or what lay after that, was there? So there were all these other exciting dynamics based in and around not only getting to the North Pole, landing on the North Pole, but also what happens after that.
That's a brilliant point. When you look at the New York Times, when I do this as a presentation, you look at the New York Times for March 1926, and there's a huge unexplored area, you know, on the other side of the North Pole. And that was still mapped in 1928, 1929. So, no one knew what was there. People thought it could be a continent or at least some large islands, perhaps some kind of strange sea. So lots of stories going around. Yeah, and that was obviously what was propelling these missions was what also propelled Antarctic exploration, which we don't talk about as much. That's kind of imperialism.
Yeah.
Nationalism. So there was the idea they weren't just, let's fly over the North Pole to Alaska. It was, let's fly over the North Pole to Alaska. And if we can, how about grabbing some land? Or because this land may have, Svalbard has had coal, which we don't really think of being that close to the Arctic Circle, but perhaps they've got oil, on the other side. So we don't really think of that as a motivation for exploration, but it really was. It really was in this case, and which made it quite interesting because some of these expeditions were, we're going to talk about the Norwegian in a minute. There was Italian, American, and Norwegian. So who would actually get to claim the land?
It's fair to say that the Norwegians and the Scandinavian region were particularly protective of that part of the world, weren't they?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think they saw it as their. Norwegians especially felt that they'd lost out on building an empire because they've been part of Sweden until the kind of early 20th century. And they saw this as the Arctic as their empire of snow and ice, I guess you could call it, that they wanted to carve out. So they'd already grabbed Svalbard. And they had their eyes on Greenland and whatever was on the other side. So certainly, they felt very protected. So in subtext, as you say, is what the hell are these Italians doing? Because everyone knew that Mussolini liked a bit of land. I like grabbing a bit of land here and there.
Well, Amundsen then had another throw, some would say the final, but it wasn't quite, of the dice. Tell us a story about the Norge and how he came into contact with Nobly.
Okay, it's a brilliant story. Totally forgotten, even though it's like four pages of the New York Times when they flew over the North Pole. After his 1925 expedition, he'd had it with fixed-wing aircraft. He'd already talked to Nobly before, or Nobly's representatives. It's not quite totally clear. But he was already aware of the Norge, and he decided we're definitely going to go by airship, because airships give you the range that fixed-wing aircraft didn't do at the time. They give you a stable platform, so which is especially important for the navigation to prove you were there. And it gives you the kind of ability to take a lot of equipment, perhaps land at the North Pole and do all these other things. So he was very keen to use an airship. The only airship that was available was one built by Umberto Nobly, the Italian genius designer, engineer, pilot, descendant of nobility, a friend of the Pope, friend of the Italian King, uneasy ally of Mussolini, perhaps. And so there's only one place Amundsen could go, and it's Rome and into the embrace of Mussolini. And so Amundsen is used to his leadership style was, he was the chief. Everyone, there's one leader in these extreme environments, because he thought that if you had more than one leader, you'd have dissension, division, and it's going to be disaster. You had to have one leader, everyone had to do what that person told him. But the problem with aviation is he has a passion for aviation, but then he was now dependent on other people other leaders with their own sources of authority, with their own agendas.
Yeah. He wasn't and different totally in control. Skill sets as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
They all brought skills. So tell us about the crew that he managed to assemble for that then.
Yes. So it was a kind of a combination of crew of just over half Norwegian, and then the rump of Italians who obviously knew how to fly and built it. The uneasy combination, uneasy tensions between those two groups of people, different language barriers as well, which didn't help matters, suspicions about what each other wanted. especially in some of the run-ups to the actual flight to the North Pole and beyond, there were lots of tensions. So, it wasn't an easy ship to be on, I would have thought.
And how does one get an airship from Italy to Norway?
Okay, and Svalbard, which is...
And then Svalbard.
Even further,
that,
yeah. I mean, I think that's a really good... that's a brilliant question. I think in the past they would dismantle it and kind of and ship them. I think Wellman in the 1900s, I think, dismantled it and shipped it. Nobody decided to do is fly. So he did a dog leg because these are kind of small. Although this is about the size of a jumbo jet, this is small for an airship. So most airships, most of these big Zeppelins we were talking about, were like three, four times the size. So huge aircraft. So. Yeah.
And weather critical, wasn't it?
Flying. Weather critical, absolutely. Yeah. So that was one of the big differences. If you want to come back to why it all goes wrong in the end for airships, why perhaps the Golden Age didn't last long is because the British and Americans tended to ignore the weather, you know, and a lot of the accidents occurred in really bad weather, whereas the Germans, you know, just avoided the bad weather or didn't fly or went around it. They're much more cautious in the UK. So anyway, that's a bit of a side. But so you had this airship. It was basically designed for the Mediterranean to be a pleasure cruiser for the Italian king to see his empire, and even had a throne in. So you have to remember that's its origin. So he decided to do this dogleg across from Italy to Norfolk. There's a wonderful footage, if you've gone to one of my lectures, of the kind of Nord flying over Norfolk, which is incredible. It looks like it's filmed yesterday. To Pelham, which is like a Cape Canaveral kind of place of its day, across to Oslo, for a rather nice lunch by all accounts, and then to St. Petersburg, and then to Spitsberg, to kind of more or less directly to Svalbard. So it's dogleg route, you know, to try and, you know, kind of conserve the aircraft, not put under too much pressure, also drum up a lot of attention in media as well.
And I think just again, the context around some of this is that the media, as we understand it, obviously no social media, but the press was fiercely competitive at that time, wasn't it? Newspapers were the driver for everything. And there was a lot of competition to get news and news items out. And this was a really popular news item. Amundsen was a hero of his time. You know, if we put him in today's language, he'd be a social media icon probably. So there was a lot of press around all of this as well, and what was going to happen, were they going to get there, and that sort of thing. So that was an interesting dynamic in play as well.
Yeah, and there's also kind of aviators were the kind of new, like the astronauts, so everyone wanted a part of this business. And also you had to then preserve your exclusive rights. If you sold exclusive rights, you had to preserve it. So there's wonderful stories of them up in Kings Bay trying to, and a cameraman from a newsreel company that hadn't paid for the rights, hiding behind the coal dumps, trying to film, you know, and the kind of crew trying to chase him away because obviously it undermined the value. Of their rights, and they could get into trouble as well, you know, if they hadn't protected the rights.
Yeah.
So it's a very modern world.
Right. So how did the Norge fare then? This flight of, multinational, multi-language crew, how did they get on and how did they get to the result?
Well, I mean, on the surface, it seemed to go well because they took off, you know, May 26th. From Kings Bay to Svalbard, which is kind of the furthest point you could kind of jumping off point for the North Pole and beyond. Got to the North Pole, dropped their flags. The Italians seemed to have the biggest flag, which, you know, Amundsen didn't like. So she has, nobody had made a complaint, about weight and how they had to cut down weight. And suddenly he pulled out this kind of huge flag. And he also insisted that the Norwegians left their design, their German flight suits behind too, because they were too heavy. And of course they were shivering, which probably didn't make them any happier. And they got to, and they flew over, they got to Alaska, landed a bit south of, kind of a bit further north of where they wanted to, just because of the weather and it looks like they crash when you look at the pictures, but it's going to rapid deflation. And because
love
there's no one
term.
There,
I love that term.
so there's, the problem was there's no one there because everyone was at the end destination. There wasn't a mooring mast. There was no, you need about 100, 200 people to hold the airship down. So there's nobody. So they had to kind of rapidly deflate it in order to stay on the ground. So it was an amazing flight. Great achievement. As I said, 4 pages in the New York Times, but that's when the problem started because everyone's, it started to unravel because the tensions that are built up over the name of the expedition, who was going to write a chapter in the book, which is where you make lots of money, who was going to, all this stuff had built up and exploded. Because certainly nobly, I think he wanted to restore the glory of his family. He did build this airship, he did fly it. As Amundsen, depending on your view, kind of probably sat in the armchair for most of the time. I don't want to get any hate mail, so please don't. But then Mussolini kicked in because this is all about proving the modernity, the success of the Italian fascist regime in Northern America and especially in the United States, which had a huge Italian population. And that's where, nobody couldn't afford to fail to deliver. Whatever he felt about how Amundsen was treated, he had to deliver. And they did because
But they failed in one aspect and one major aspect, which then comes back to set the next train of the story moving, and that is that they didn't land at the North Pole. They flew over it, and again, the debate about did they reach it, didn't they reach it, how could you prove it? Because again, in context, let's just talk about some of the navigation aids of the time. We were still talking about quite basic compasses and sextants and
some compasses and things like that.
So there was a lot of dispute and ultimately that led to the debate about we need to repeat this but we have to land.
I think if you look at the if you look at the attempts to fly to the North Pole, I think most people would say that Norge probably got there, because you could keep so many records. So although they might be using primitive instruments, there was a kind of a trail. But yes, I mean, it wasn't, you needed to land someone there really, didn't you? So yeah, so nobody decided he wanted to go back almost the moment he got back to Alaska. He wanted to go back to North Pole, land some poor scientists and then come back for them. If they could ever find them again, I went up to Svalbard to research the book, and there's something about the landscape, the huge mountains, the grasses, the whiteness, that bores into your soul. So I just wanted to, whenever I was getting stressed from the deadlines, I just wanted to go back to the Arctic. And so I think there's a part of him under pressure in Italy because of all the politics he was going to face. No, this was a place you could go back to. And also I think Amundsen obviously wasn't very happy about being kind of ignored in America. And he and his allies had a good pop at Nobly, and he wrote this book called, My Life as an Explorer, really attacks Nobly. So a little bit of that hurt Nobly.
Yeah.
And he wanted to go back as well to prove the Italians could do it without the Norwegians.
Okay. We're back in Italy, where the process kickstarts again. Tell us about some of the other characters. We mentioned Mussolini, but we've got one or two others. We've got Balbo and Crocco.
They didn't like him before he went to North Pole and the Norge. I mean, lots of jealousies. I mean, it's a small world. I mean, it's a small world in an authoritarian regime. Stakes are high. Aviation is the future. So there's lots at play. And I didn't like him before he went to North Pole with Amundsen. They certainly didn't like him afterwards. I mean, become depending on the source, become an honorary member of the fascist party. He'd earned a lot of money. He'd become a general. Sky high, international profile. I mean, he always had one industry, but this was kind of outside. This is in public opinion. So people hated him, I think. One guy in particular, Italo Balbo, rose to kind of help found the Italian Air Force. And he hated, what's the phrase? There's no women in the Italian Air Force for prima donnas. And of course, he was the biggest prima donna.
Yes, of course.
And he hated it, nobody. And what I was able to do some of my research, I mean, was to show that the same thing happened to other pilots, like nobody, who dared to build up this profile. No matter how close they were to Balbo, they always ended the same in kind of disgrace and exile.
Yeah.
The record men, he called them. I think there's a famous quote he also said, that there's not enough room in this cockpit for the two of us. I think that was a... So he was after him. And nobody made some bad moves, going to Japan, leaving Balbo, with Mussolini alone. And when he came back, his airship he was building, was dismantled, destroyed, and melted down. So not just cancelled, but melted down.
Yeah.
And then every time he saw Mussolini, Balbo was there, and Mussolini he'd known for a long time. So everything had changed. Mussolini tries to persuade him not to go back to the North Pole. Says, why risk luck a second time? You've got, it's been a success.
Which was quite insightful, actually, wasn't it? In that publicity world that was emerging, it was take the gains you've got, why risk it? It could go wrong. Something could happen, it seemed quite insightful. But the point I just wanted to also ask you to just expand on is Mussolini was slightly afraid of Balbo as well, wasn't he?
And Balbo was brilliant. Another journalist, so you have to be careful of these, of these journalists, and a street, violent street fighter. I mean, he was one of the four founders of the Fascist Party. He's prone to fits of violence, as Mussolini was, but I think more extreme. So, it was said that Mussolini was frightened of Balbo. So there's a strange relationship there. And I've got this picture using the presentation of Mussolini giving kind of Balbo his pilot's license. And it's kind of... I know he's always blushing. There's a kind of weird relationship between the men. On one hand, there's fear. There's an atmosphere of violence, rivalry. But there's also something odd there, just in the sense of friendship. There's something, else there. And so that was really interesting. And so Balbo, the moment nobody leaves Mussolini, Balbo says, let him go because he can't possibly come back to bother us again.
So ultimately, they sort of were hoping that he would fail in some ways. Certainly Balbo was.
Yeah, Balbo was hoping he'd fail, but leaving the door open just enough in case he succeeded. Yeah, and obviously the worst thing, so he's hoping he was going to fail. Kind of allowed it to happen, I guess, just in case it did work.
Allowed
him to raise money for it. But also sabotage it in a way by not letting him have kind of rescue planes and the kind of the paraphernalia he should have had around him.
Yeah, so, there was no support structure for him, was there?
Did you know that in the late 1940s, during atomic weapons testing in the Pacific, the USA used Boeing B-17 Flying Fortresses as unmanned radio-controlled drones? Did you also know that in 1927, two RAF officers in a Hawker Horsley set a new distance record, flying from Britain to the Persian Gulf, only for it to be eclipsed just hours later by Charles Lindbergh's Solar Atlantic crossing, which was a mere 180 miles longer? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
Aviation media has long been the domain of the newspapers and magazines.
Well, not anymore. I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran, and we're bringing aviation right into your radio.
Yes, we're making aviation cool and interesting for everyone.
Hang on, aviation's always been cool. Check this out.
How cool is this?
Grant, turn that down. Here at Plane Crazy Down Under, we've got pilots, engineers, air traffic controllers, industry leaders, even politicians dropping by to talk to us about the amazing world of aviation right here in Australia and occasionally in New Zealand as well.
Wow, that's cooler than I thought, mate.
Find us at planecrazydownunder.com, on iTunes, or lurking about on other people's podcasts just like this one.
We've got crazy accents and lots of great aviation content.
And we promise not to talk about the cricket.
No, never, not the cricket. Quack, 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 quack. What is cricket anyhow?
Something we win a lot. Oh, there
oh!
We go.
Once he built the new airship, which was the Italia,
yeah.
He attempted to create a similar route to back to the North Pole, didn't he? He didn't quite go as planned, though.
That's right, because things had changed, really. He couldn't go to Norfolk because the British were concentrating all their airship development in Cardington. So it wasn't, you know, and various things like that happened in the years since. So he decided to go direct. So direct from Rome to Milan to northern Germany through the mountains of central Europe. I mean, you know, there's a description of a storm. And this massive airship is flying down the mountain valleys because it couldn't fly too high because it was probably going to get struck by lightning and burst into flames. So this huge airship is flying down the mountain valleys in central Europe, obviously not really knowing what's ahead, relying on pilot's instinct.
Yeah.
You know, astonishing feats. And you know, and these aircraft weren't designed for this kind of punishment. So it got to northern Germany, quite battered. And he got delayed there waiting for repairs. You know, and obviously nobody knew that he couldn't wait too long. He couldn't go back to Rome because he probably would never be allowed.
He couldn't go back. He could only go forward. And the other thing was that weather and time of year was starting to play a part because, as you mentioned earlier, the North Pole is very weather dependent. They had a very small window to get through. I was just going to ask you, Mark, to tell us about the crew that he then assembled.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I think the difference is, the big difference with the crew of Norwich is this is an all Italian crew. You know, I think apart from the scientists and the meteorologists, as Czech and Swedish, it's basically an all Italian crew. And it was designed to prove, you know, the Italians can do it. You know, and he actually kind of had a competition in the paper so people could write in and try and apply. But, you know, it's basically his old hands, most of the people from the Norge. So, again, that's one of the point. Nearly all the Italians who signed up for the Norge signed up for the Italia. He had some other people along who are probably also trained in airships, some experience, but who were probably more pro Mussolini. So that was beginning to creep in there. Could he trust some of these people? So it's a very different kind of crew, kind of all owing their loyalty to him, really, other than some of these officers who were there, perhaps. Obviously, journalists from the fascist newspapers, perhaps, you know, report, perhaps to keep an eye, you know, not sure. You know, you're not sure what's going on there. So very different kind of crew and kind of very patriotic.
Yeah.
So a very different setup.
They had a support ship and they had very basic radios, didn't they, at that time? But it was on the cutting edge of new radio technology.
Absolutely. Because Macagni was Italian exile.
Yeah, of course.
He was a pro-fascist. So he helped in 1926. You know, there's wonderful stories about the radio he gave the Norge in 1926, and he's back there in 1928 again. And when he died, you know, Mussolini sent a wreath, you know, to his funeral. So, I mean, he was a fascist. So he gave them equipment to be able to contact Rome directly, to broadcast around the world. You know, but there was a danger that most of the local ships didn't have the same equipment, so they couldn't actually. The rescue ships probably couldn't actually hear, you know, but they could hear the world. So I mean, it's very.
Yeah.
I mean, so there's danger of being too much at the cutting edge. You know, the rest of the world hadn't caught up.
Yeah, and all that rushing to get to to start the flight in anger from Salzburg, meant that particularly Nobly, who was the pilot, he'd flown all the way from Italy through this terrible weather. They'd had all these challenges. He was actually exhausted before they actually got going, wasn't he?
Absolutely. I think he was exhausted. The crew was exhausted. The ship had even been damaged when it was there, you know, and in the storm, and they had to brush off the snow from the roof, from the top of the envelope. And they'd done this incredibly long trip as well, along the Siberian coast, over 2,500 miles and back to the same point. So, you know, they were absolutely exhausted. In those days, the leadership style was very much about the individual, the heroic leader. You didn't sleep. You know, that was his job for your men. You stayed in control. So, certainly, I mean, there's some wonderful research done by NASA into what happens with Italia. And one of the factors is a human factor, is the fact that he was demonstrating clear sleep deprivation, some of the symptoms of sleep deprivation. Towards the end. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how he kept going, I think, and kept in command. But the problem was, there wasn't really anyone who he could make a second in command, because he didn't really feel he could trust them, because the airship specialists who were there were more kind of either had their own agenda, suddenly closer to the regime, so he couldn't really give them that authority. So there was no one there really who felt they could question, you know, his leadership.
And before we cover the flight of the Italia on over the pole, where was Amundsen in all of this second?
He had been sulking because, you know, he was close to retirement, so the Norge and all the money he was going to make from the flight of Norge was going to pay for his retirement, and obviously nobody came, and that was all based on attention, like, as you said, an influencer, but nobody come along and stole his followers, I guess. So he had been sulking, wrote this awful book, you know, the My Life as an Explorer, that criticized everyone. He was depressed. And I think what came across as I wrote the story was his long history of depression. And at times his friends were regularly worried about him and his actions. So a very different kind of man that I remember as a child being taught about. But I think there's some sense by he fallen out with his right-hand man, Lisa Larson, who was kind of taking the opportunity a bit to become the new guy on the block. But there's some sense he'd kind of come out of his shell a bit. So in May 1925, he's in Oslo celebrating Flight Wilkins. He did this kind of, I don't know why it was celebrated quite so much, but it was kind of from North America to Svalbard, kind of the reverse of the Norse route, but it's dogleg, so he stopped. It's a fixed-wing aircraft, so he got to stop a number of times. But this was seen as an amazing achievement. So they're busy celebrating that as the Norge set off.
Right,
but everyone knew they hated each other. I think that's the key thing. Like, when I gave this talk at the National Maritime Museum, a couple of people came afterwards saying, "Come on, you're overemphasizing it." And I said, "No, in his own words, no, in the words of the people at the time, everyone knew the two men did not get on, because it was a very public feud. It wasn't hidden.
So nobly driven by his desire to get there, and let's not forget to land at the North Pole. Mm. Sets off. Tell us about the last fateful days of the Italia.
So this should have been the easiest trip. It's only 500 miles, 600 miles. A few days ago, he'd flown 2,500 miles, so this should have been easy. The weather's brilliant on the way up. We get pushed along by the winds, but of course, the winds are pushing you on. You've got to fly back into. So even as he's approaching the North Pole, he's starting to get worried. And his weather guy, Malgrim, who's a Swedish chap, kept reassuring him, "It's going to be fine, don't worry about it." Whereas nobody's already thinking of alternative plans. It gets to the North Pole, record time, but the wind is too strong, so he can't land anyone. Now, he wanted to land himself first, and then some scientists after that. And that was bad news for him, because in terms of media rights, he would get a bonus for landing people at the North Pole.
Yeah.
So that wasn't so good, but that must increase the pressure on him as well, knowing all these, you know, safety versus, you know, so they didn't land, jolly good time, proved the Italians could get to the North Pole. Then he had to make a decision. Does he fly back over to somewhere like Alaska or Canada? In which case he would just have to do another emergency kind of,
Rapid deflation.
Rapid deflation. And the plane would be wrecked, but he'd done that before, so it wouldn't really be news. So again, this is where the news agenda comes in.
Yeah.
That wouldn't really be news. And the ship would be wrecked. Or does he do a bigger route back, like he did kind of almost before, back round the Arctic Ocean, back round the Siberian coast, huge long route, but avoiding all the bad weather. And that would also be a heroic achievement in his own. Or does he go turn around and go straight into the wind, straight back to King's Bay? Now, the Amalgam persuades him that the weather is going to abate. If he turns around and just goes straight back to King's Bay, then the weather will get easier and it will be a straightforward flight, more or less straightforward flight. And, of course, it doesn't turn out that way. It's a disastrous decision. The weather gets worse and worse and worse. Storms get stronger and more powerful. At certain points, they're even being blown backward or barely being able to make any forward movement at all. So it's a terrible decision.
And the weather, we now know so much more, but the weather was just shocking. Ice, snow build up. And when those things happened, how did they keep that airframe airworthy? How did they keep it up in the air with all that ice and snow on the propellers, on the envelope?
That's a brilliant question. I think on one hand, they were going around trying to knock all the ice off, repair. And remember, you had blocks of ice being flung off from the propellers. The ice was forming on the propellers or near the propellers, and it's being flung off. So they had to try and repair, the envelope where it got damaged, using kind of dope, redoping it. Some people would have to climb it, unbelievable, have to climb up the outside of the airship and brush off the snow and ice forming in the storm. I mean, incredibly, dangerous times, and they were, in brutal conditions. I mean, these were like flying tents, the gondola. It wasn't like, it wasn't like Hindenburg. It was like a flying tent with kind of air and cold winds coming through everywhere. So very brutal conditions. And it was kind of obviously a losing battle to some extent.
Well, they lost the battle. What happened?
Absolutely. So they kept going up. They tried to escape, got up into the sun. Then they can only stay up there for so long until the kind of gas expands too much and they have to come back down again. Do they let out too much gas? So when they got into the cold conditions, it kind of shrunk and then they kind of dropped. There's lots of arguments about what happened. But basically, in the early hours of May 25th, 1928, they kind of hit the tail on the ice, which is different from what I imagined. I thought it was a proper crash. It was actually just the tail smashed into the ice. The gondola got ripped off. And about half of the crew and a load of supplies were thrown onto the ice. I like the story that one of the crew still in the envelope of the airship realized what was happening and threw the survival packs out. There's some debate about whether it just seemed too convenient otherwise, that all the right stuff was on the ice. But the other men, a couple of them were still asleep, in the envelope. And there's a horrific picture that nobody writes, of these guys looking down at them, their fate gradually dawning on them that they were in this airship, really, uncontrollable.
So it literally in several pieces, and that top part that had broken away and was ripped floated away with the men in it.
Yeah, with no engines and no form of control. Yeah. They're never seen again. Perhaps under the Arctic ice.
So, what about the survivors then?
Well, the survivors, obviously fairly traumatic experience. A lot of them are badly injured. Nobody is really badly injured. He thinks he's dying. They face, in the end, 2 months out on the sea ice trying to survive. Nobody gradually loses control. And that's one of the criticisms of him. And I guess he's not an explorer, So in the sense of, so he's badly injured. He'd lost his confidence. He's made some bad decisions. So he gradually feels he can't tell some of the men who want to leave. He can't stop them leaving.
So the team breaks up.
Three of them and the Swedish guy, Swedish navigator, who's very depressed. He tries to take his own life almost immediately. I think he clearly holds himself responsible for what happens. They try and walk out over the sea ice, which is a classic explorer thing to do. If we get into any trouble, we can just walk out. But obviously this is, you know, it's horrendous. You've got ice varying thickness. It can be suddenly be, you know, centimeter thick and plunges you down into the water. It moves. And what they quickly found was that the wind was blowing them, because you've got these little islands. So they thought they could walk to that, you know, the actual kind of solid island, then perhaps would recover and then, you know, make another jump or get some help. And the problem was that the wind was actually blowing the sea ice further away than they were walking every day. So it's a dismal situation out in the open.
Now, I was just going to say, Mark, not to put too fine a point on it, you go into a great deal of detail in the book. It's a real human tragedy story, this bit. And this is the bit I found really gripping. So people will have to buy the book to get the detail. But what we had here was a number of individuals stranded on the ice. Mm. They had a radio, but tell us about the circumstances they faced and how the rescue or attempted rescue started to kick in.
Okay, yeah. I mean, they disappeared. No one knew where they went. The last broadcast was a few hours earlier, so no one quite knows where they were. They had a radio, so they thought, oh, fantastic, we're going to get rescued in no time. But for some reason, no one could hear their broadcasts, but they could hear the world searching for them. So heartbreaking. They could hear them searching in the wrong location. So it must have been horrific. They're all having dinner, like an Avengers movie, like a Marvel movie, in this wonderful restaurant in Oslo. The telegram boy rushes in with the news that the Talia has disappeared. Now, and the Norwegian government wants kind of volunteers to help search for the airship. And the whole room turns towards Amundsen. Again, some of you think I was making this up when I was talking about this in this lecture. Now, this all happened, and they turn around, and one of the observers says everyone in the room knew Amundsen nobly hated each other. So what was Amundsen going to do? And he stands up and goes, tell them I am coming.
Is there film rights to this, Mark? Is there film rights?
Yeah,
great scene.
There are people who wants them to contact me. They would do, yeah. So you could argue about why he said that, but clearly he felt he had to. So you have this wonderful moment, but then it turns out no one really wants him involved, really. I mean, because their rescue effort gets going with planes, ships, men coming from all over Europe and even North America, kind of more or less being organized a bit by Risa Larsson, his former right-hand man, who's now kind of taken over, really. So Amundsen hates that.
Yeah.
Kind of getting funded to some extent by the Italians, but Mussolini's made it clear he wants Amundsen nowhere near this because of Amundsen's clash of nobly. And to be honest, there's probably people in the Norwegian government who don't want Amundsen involved as well, because they've read My Life of an Explorer. They've seen what he said about people, and they don't want – he's by this stage, he's become a bit of a loose cannon. You're not sure what's going to happen. That rescue effort builds up. All the planes congregate in kind of Tromsø in northern Norway, where the Tirpitz ended up, which I have no idea to us. So my brain made a connection when I was watching a documentary the other day. For the jump to Svalbard. Now, the more kind of seaplanes were kind of tied to trawlers and things and shipped over, whereas the big kind of flying boats flew and usually flew together for safety. And, of course, when Amundsen was desperate to join this, and in the end, his allies found him a French flying boat, and the French government said, yes, you can have this, and you can have some of our best aviators, the poor guys. It's a prototype flying boat. It's slightly old-fashioned in its structure. In the lecture, we were shown the video of the plane taking off. Whereas the Dornier Walls we were talking about earlier, would just fly across the ice. Whereas this plane was taking off for the Wandon Rivers in France, and it was so laboured. So you could tell straight away it was underpowered. Now, it's kind of more wooden in construction. So it wasn't designed for the Arctic. And it had kind of a bit of a bad history. The first prototype did. So it turns out later that the crew were quite worried about the plane, but they felt they had no choice. But for France, but they had to. Had to go.
Yeah. Because, in this rescue attempt, the whole press and the whole world then became, well, who's going to be the ones who go out there and save them? So they all started to compete to be the best rescuer.
Absolutely, yeah. And there's massive competition between nations, between the different individuals, between the governments. I mean, it's a very competitive place. And obviously Arnesen couldn't back out. He said he was going to go, so he had to go.
Okay. And there were several failed attempts as well by various aircraft. Some even eventually found them, but weren't able to land.
So it took a long time. I mean, the aircraft were operating in the limits of their range, and no one knew where it was.
Yeah.
So you were searching in all sorts of different places. So some failed attempts. Sometimes planes disappeared and were found, just hold up, waiting for some petrol or something like this. But it was eventually found, and they were able to send resupply. So the first attempts, how do we parachute supplies down, was interesting. But the first plane who found them also had a film crew in the tail. So it was circling around going, hey, we found you guys, but nobody realised there's a cameraman filming them all.
And he
felt kind of pulled by that because they were in this disgusting kind of state. And then a rival newsreel didn't get that footage. So there's this image that on the photo libraries say is of the camp, but actually I think lots of people suspect it's actually a model made up because they couldn't get the footage. So they kind of made up a model, faked.
Okay.
Faked the picture.
Before they found Nobly, Amundsen's attempt failed, didn't it?
That's right, yes. Yeah. So Amundsen gets to Toronto, but refuses to join any of these kind of group flights to Kings Bay. I mean, this is what he's always done. He's been a loner, kept his plans to himself. But in the age of aviation, that becomes increasingly difficult because you can travel vast distances. No one knows if you've crashed. So he heads off, for the flight to Kings Bay, takes off, disappears into a car bank, is never seen again. So as they gradually working out where Nobly is, they gradually realize that Amundsen has disappeared.
And he's also lost.
He's also lost. So you've got a strange moment when almost relief. Okay, we found Nobly. We can divert all the resources to look for Amundsen. So to some extent, Nobly and his men they're found, but they're stranded because everyone's too busy looking for.
God, it's just such a terrible disaster, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. Absolutely. And, so the only thing they ever find of Amundsen's plane is a pontoon that looks like it's been ripped off and two huge fuel tanks. But like MH370, there's lots of debris which may or may not be part of the plane.
Yeah.
Some of it's been now lost over the last 100 years. And lots of eyewitness accounts, and some people even on their deathbeds. I was reading 20 years ago, around 2000s, there were still old people going, I never told anyone this, but I saw this plane. There's so many theories, so many ideas. No one knows what happened to
it. Okay. But having established where Nobly was, into the Soviet Union.
We've found Nobly. It's kind of quite close to Svalbard. I think it's just to northeast of Svalbard. Closer than people thought, but still at the limits of range of aircraft. So one Swedish, Lundberg, this kind of mercenary spy-like figure, a man of mystery, manages to land in this kind of single engine two-seater biplane on the ice, which is kind of an amazing achievement.
Yeah.
I think his navigator was ashen at the end. And he jumps off, and nobody thinks he's going to start rescuing kind of injured first. And he goes straight to Nobly and goes, I've orders to take you first. No, which wow. goes against all the rules of the sea.
Yeah.
Kept the social yeah. the last.
Yeah.
You know, Nobly is, but Nobly's really badly injured. He's not in any position to be making judgment calls. And he kind of lets himself be persuaded, bullied. And again, no one will tell him, I don't think you should go. So he lets himself be taken away. And of course, that's what his enemies love now. He's deserted his men.
Yeah.
So he finds himself in house arrest. You know, in boat arrest, if you want to call it that, but armed guards at the end of his corridors. But the Swedish guy decides to go back, or honour his pledge to rescue the other men, which perhaps would have made it all right if he had rescued them. But he crashes on the return trip and is stranded there. Right. Stranded there himself.
I shouldn't laugh.
No.
He gets stranded with them. And of course, they've been on the ice for a good few months at this point, haven't they?
Well, they'd have been on the ice for about a month by now, just over a month.
Okay, about a month.
Yeah.
Right.
But, you know, this is out in the open. They've got one small tent. You know, they're injured. I wouldn't want to spend, you know, over a month in those conditions out on the Arctic.
On the ice. Yeah. They were exposed. But they were rescued, and they were rescued by a Soviet icebreaker, weren't they?
That's right. Yeah, because gradually, Stalin sensed an opportunity. So this is the other narrative. Stalin senses an opportunity in all this to show the value of the Soviet Union and what it's capable of. So he does stand this old icebreaker in Leningrad, built in Britain. The most powerful ones, found the old crew, got the old crew back together again, whether they wanted to or not. And then rammed it full of pilots, strapped some planes on, newspaper people, obviously, probably security police as well. And their mission is to rescue the crew. And they do it. They go further north than any ship that size has ever got to before. They got to within 100 feet of the camp because once the sea ice is, you can break through. A number of times they wanted to go back because they had problems with the propeller or fuel. They're running out of fuel. And the message from Stalin was, you don't come back. You know, you rescue these men or you don't come back.
It was quite clear,
wasn't it? It was very clear. So you got this wonderful image after all the hullabaloo about aviation. Actually, it's rescued by this old kind of late 19th century icebreaker, coal-powered, smashed its way through. And okay, the Russians did use planes, would stop and load the planes, fly them, and they use it as for reconnaissance to work out where the other different people who needed rescuing were. So aviation still played a key role, but given the situation, I think the pilots and then as the Russian ship got close, Soviet ship got closer, a lot of pilots went, well, we're not even going to risk trying to land to rescue these guys. The ship's coming, so they can just wait. So it's a bit unfortunate. Because whenever anyone did try to land, something always went
missing or injured or something.
Yeah, so there's an amazing picture.
Yeah.
The ship right by the camp.
We'll put that picture in the show notes. Prove we're not all about aviation. We'll put a boat in there. But let's just look at how should we describe the post rescue events then? Mm. Because that whole issue about Nobly getting off first, and as you said, boat arrest is not an inappropriate description.
Yeah.
But of course, heading back to Scandinavia, there was a massive amount of ill feeling because Amundsen had been lost.
Yeah, absolutely. So Amundsen had died, but Nobly had survived. It seemed wrong, you know, to lots of Scandinavians. So he'd been kept isolated. So he didn't know what was going on. He didn't know what the government, his own government, was saying about him. So they get to back at Tromsø. The dock workers refused to let the Italians set foot on Norwegian soil. So they had to get to the train to take them back to Italy on a long gangplank. They weren't allowed to set foot. There were kind of almost like mob mood. It was probably quite good that they didn't set foot. There may well have been kind of various awful things happen. So they got into the train. It's been compared to the train that took Lenin back to Russia. I mean, yes, it was chartered by the Italians. Yes, they had a special coach, but they weren't imprisoned. I mean, I think journalists love this comparison, but it was kind of more, it was more, they were advised not to wander around the train because obviously, you know, who else was there? So the train made this wonderful journey down, you know, different reactions in different cities. Some places love them, some places hated them, and generally seemed to divide the Protestant parts of Europe, thought they were scoundrels. You know, the Catholic parts saw them as heroes, but they weren't sure at all what was going to happen when they got to Italy. But when they got to Italy, they were greeted as heroes, whatever Mussolini tried to portray them. Because for the fascists, they wanted them dead, really. Now, it's better to die as martyrs than as this kind of... but they got to Italy and they were heroes and they were mobbed. And nobody should have played this better. So they could have negotiated a settlement with the regime, probably been quite happy, at least for a time. But instead, he kind of let his rage. I guess he'd been badly injured. He had PTSD. One of the other things on the train, he got all the newspapers and he saw the lies his own government were printing about him. So it'd be like if the crew of the Apollo 13 got back to in America and discovered the government had been saying they're incompetent and cowards. So it's that kind of level of. So he's furious. So he refused to see Italia Balba when he arrives, which by protocol he should have seen him. And obviously for a street fighter, that kind of challenge is, it's not acceptable.
The gauntlet was down, wasn't it?
Sees Mussolini, but loses it, and has a blazing row with Mussolini. I think someone says no one had talked to Mussolini like that for a long time, but somehow isn't killed on the spot. But then after that, you know, all the mechanisms of the fascist state kind of fell on him, you know, to destroy his reputation, to ruin everything. And then luckily Uncle Joe Stalin asked him to come to Russia and build airships because like the Americans, the British, he saw airships as a way to unite the Soviet Union. So Aeroflot, but we're going to build a fleet of airships.
Yeah, and he escaped and lived in Moscow for a while, didn't he?
He lived in Moscow for a while, seemed to have a charmed life where, you know, other people like the British Vickers engineers were prosecuted on show trials and many others just disappeared. So he seemed to live a charmed life, got access to the Kremlin hospital when he was really ill. A wonderful moment when the New York Times published his obituary. When he was still alive.
When he's not dead. Yeah,
when he's not dead, But it was on this backdrop they were putting huge resources into it, but it was on this backdrop of increased secret police surveillance of it, people around him, people disappearing, the build-up to the purges. But somehow he was always all right. And he described it as the most wonderful time of his life. I suppose socialism, perhaps what the fascists always thought was actually true to some extent. And he was able to leave, I mean, as well, which is lots of people never left.
I was going to use the term escaped, but he did leave. And the story does continue, but we're running out of time now.
I think that's a good point too.
Tell us about what's the legacy of Nobly and the Italia?
Oh my God, that is a really good question. I mean, I could guess you could go, is there a legacy? I think the legacy is, I suppose we see it now in the SpaceX, you know, Elon Musk SpaceX versus Blue Origin, the sense of pride, egos, propelling technology forward, perhaps at great cost to people's lives. I think that's the legacy there in the sense of technology doesn't always develop in the way that we imagine it will be. It will do. And also nature of fame. I mean, it's bizarre. In fact, it was a disaster. It meant that he, in the end, had quite a wealthy wealthy life, whereas his great successful flight, yeah, you know, is totally forgotten. And I think for Italians, you know, that they still have, you know, they have a base up in Kings Bay, scientific base. They have oil interests in the Arctic. So I think if Italian, you'll see him as a great pioneer of Italian aviation, because the Italians have designed them some amazing aircraft.
And he ended his life reasonably wealthy, didn't he, for some interesting reasons?
Yeah. So he went to America, went to Spain, he was in exile, still a patriot, so he did come back to Italy. When the fascists were overturned, one of the first things the government, new government did was pardon. I think pardon is probably the wrong word, but kind of expunge his record. Overturned what the fascists said about him and gave him years of back pay. He lived a very nice life. He outlived all his rivals, Hugo Eckner, Balbo, all these people, and he even won a court case against Hugo Eckner, and his son as well, who accused him of being incompetent in a book published in the 60s. Lots of people told me about this book in the industry, but I could never find any reference to it. Or I could find reference to the book, but not a book with this added chapter. And eventually I found the reference. And he won in London, good old London courts, and he won his legal case. So he had the last laugh, really.
Well, if that is not a flavour of the book, I don't know what is. I mean, it goes from twist to turn to human drama to travesty to rescue to heroism. It's a fabulous, fabulous read, Mark. I really enjoyed it, knew nothing about it, but much the richer for reading the book. So thanks so much for joining us. But before I let you go, I want to ask you a question I didn't ask you a little while ago. There was a bit of a teaser about Britain's Area 51 and also the last Nazi helicopter, was it? Any plans to do anything exciting for another book based on any of that?
I've got some ideas about both of those stories. We've got interest in another book proposal first, but I think I'll be developing those because you've got these long delays when you send your proposal off, no matter how good it is. So I think in one of those gaps, I'll be developing some of those.
We're excited.
Other ideas, watch this space. There's a lot going on, I think.
Good. Loved your writing style. So look out for that. Just before I let you go then, Mark, where can we find you online?
Brilliant. I've got a website called www.markpison.com. I usually keep it up to date, but sometimes there's a bit of delay. So you can see all my work on there, all my stuff about the book, critics reviews, podcasts, my journalism, all that stuff's on there. You can find me on social media, usually at Mark Pising, on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook. I think on Instagram it's at Mark Pising Writes for some reason, and also on the new one, what's it called? New Instagram, Twitter.
Threads.
I'm on there. I don't know if anyone really is using it, but there you go. So you can find me in all that. You can email me, mpising@gmail.com. And if you have an event, I'd love to come and speak to you about any of these topics. Or just come and talk to me if you see me around at any of these. I was at the Royal International Air Institute at the weekend. If you see me around, come and say hi.
Excellent. Right, Mark, thank you very much. That's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts as well as the extended family of supporters, including, of course, Mick Oakey at the Aviation Historian and our good friend Simon Jakubowski at the Aviation Enthusiasts Book Club. We continue to bring you diverse and original aviation content. If you enjoy our program, leave us a review or feedback on your podcast player. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find Tim, Gareth and Ellie on the extended Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and now Threads feeds. Mm-hmm. That's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Mark.
Goodbye. Thank you for having me, Peter.
Thank you. And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Extend it!
This is XTP Media.